Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a former FBI special agent and discuss the limits the White House and the Senate Judiciary Committee placed on the supplemental FBI investigation into the accusations made by Dr. Ford against Judge Kavanaugh, who now appears to be all but assured the Republicans will have enough votes to seat him on the Supreme Court for life. Asha Rangappa, Associate Dean at Yale Law School, who teaches national security law and previously served as a special agent with the FBI specializing in counterintelligence, joins us to discuss her article at Just Security. Here are the 30 people the FBI needs to interview in its Kavanaugh investigation and what we know about the still-secret White House directive that circumscribed the latest FBI investigation. We will look into the relationship between Brett Kavanaugh and FBI Director Chris Wray, who was 2 years behind Kavanaugh at Yale and worked with him in the George W. Bush administration, as did Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, all of whom are members of Leonard Leo's Federalist Society, the conservative group behind getting Scalia, Roberts, Alito, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh seated on the Supreme Court. Then we will speak with Frank Schaefer, whose parents, Francis and Edith Schaefer, were the founders of the religious right in this country, which meant Frank worked with such figures as Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and Focus on the Family's James Dobson. We will discuss what appears to be a great victory for the religious right, who are poised to get an anti-abortion fifth right-wing judge on the Supreme Court, and the moral bankruptcy of so-called Christians reflected in the recent study that found over 40% of evangelicals would still support Kavanaugh for the Supreme Court, even if he was found guilty of the sexual assault of a 15-year-old girl. Then finally, we will speak with world-renowned presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin about her latest book, Leadership in Turbulent Times. Having written major works on Teddy Roosevelt, LBJ, FDR, and Lincoln in the runaway bestseller Team of Rivals, the basis for Steven Spielberg's Academy Award-winning film Lincoln, we will discuss her latest book on all of the aforementioned presidents and assess how good leaders become great leaders. This in contrast to our current leader, who Senator Ben Sasse, a member of Trump's own Republican Party, just said, quote, is unable to lead the country. And joining us now is Asha Rangappa, who's Associate Dean at Yale Law School, who teaches national security law and related courses at Wesleyan University, the Jackson Institute for Global Affairs at Yale University, and the University of New Haven. And previously, she served as a special agent at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, specializing in counterintelligence investigations, and now is a political analyst on CNN. She co-authored the article at Just Security. Here are the 30 people the FBI needs to interview in its Kavanaugh investigation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Asha Rangappa.
Thank you for having me.
So clearly, the 30 people that you listed in the article were not interviewed, particularly the most important of whom are, of course, Brett Kavanaugh himself and Dr. Blasey Ford. So how do you see this investigation now that it's over and they're rushing to confirm Judge Kavanaugh?
Well, this doesn't seem to me to be a sincere effort to find the truth behind these allegations, or in the course of a background check, which is different than a criminal investigation. It's not meant to, you know, find guilt or innocence, but just to see whether they're, you know, there is a character issue or a fitness issue in terms of this person, you know, going on the Supreme Court. If they didn't interview all of those people that are listed in that article, I think it's just incomplete.
Well, but it seems that the White House and the Republicans played a pretty clever game, in as much as Donald Trump kept telling us that this was a wide open FBI investigation with the FBI having a free rein. But then we find out that, in fact, it was very, very limited. And we also have never seen whatever the document is that started with Grassley on the Senate Judiciary Committee, went to Don McGahn, and that's where the FBI got its marching orders, in a document that has not been made public, but clearly limits and restricts this investigation.
I completely agree with you. You know, In the course of a normal background investigation, there would be very obvious leads and people with knowledge or information that you would contact. And since they didn't, I feel that the logical conclusion here is that they were instructed either not to interview certain witnesses or given a restrictive witness list from the White House. It's important to remember, as I mentioned just now, this isn't a criminal investigation. There's no independent authority here under the statutes of the United States or its criminal justice mandate to kind of go on its own to interview people. When the FBI is doing a background check, they are essentially acting as subcontractors for a customer who is looking for information on the suitability of a candidate for employment. So here, the customer is the White House, and they are, in many ways, bound to what the White House wants to know. So I think you're absolutely right that the question is, what were the instructions that were given to the FBI? And I will just add, Ian, that if those instructions were given by Don McGahn himself, he has a conflict of interest. He is the one who selected Judge Kavanaugh. I believe he's known Judge Kavanaugh for a while, so he has a vested interest in kind of seeing his own candidate go through, and I think it would be especially problematic if he were involved in somehow stymieing the FBI's investigation.
Well, it's not just Don McGahn, though, who knows Kavanaugh and has worked with him. Rod Rosenstein also worked with him in the Bush White House, as did Christopher Wray, the new head of the FBI, all of whom are members of the Federalist Society, along with Don McGahn. So, and of course, Leonard Leo, the head of the Federalist Society, basically has gotten Scalia, Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, and if he gets a fifth one on the court, then they've got a permanent majority. So I'm not suggesting that there's any kind of collusion there with Chris Wray, Rod Rosenstein, and McGahn. But Chris Wray was 2 years behind Judge Kavanaugh at Yale and Yale Law School. So they've known each other for some time. Do you think that is a factor to be considered?
No, I don't. I mean, just to be frank with you, when you start getting into these government circles and, you know, particularly in legal circles, everybody's going to know each other. That is just kind of how things roll, at least here in the United States. They're moving in and out of the government. You know, there are a few top law schools that funnel people into government positions. Yale is one of them. So I think just saying, oh, they went to law school together and they were both in the same club, you know, I don't think that Christopher Wray and Rod Rosenstein, when they are operating in their capacity in the Department of Justice and the FBI, I mean, these are people who've stood up to the President of the United States, so I don't think they're going to be, like, trying to suddenly cut corners with regard to a judicial candidate. There is basically kind of a systematic way that you go about doing a background check, and I don't see internally the FBI trying to cut that short unless they are getting explicit instructions to do so from the customer that they are performing the check for. That's my opinion. I don't think that there would be any strings being pulled here by Rod Rosenstein or Christopher Wray.
And again, I'm speaking with Usha Rangappa, who's the Associate Dean at Yale Law School, who teaches national security law and related courses at Wesleyan University, the Jackson Institute for Global Affairs at Yale University, and the University of New Haven. And previously, she served as a special agent at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, specializing in counterintelligence investigation, and now is a political analyst at CNN. And she co-authored the article at Just Security, "Here are the 30 people the FBI needs to interview in its Kavanaugh investigation." So when you talk about the customer being the White House, does that mean that we maybe should look at the relationship that the FBI has with the executive branch? And I recall, for example, when Bill Clinton was president, the relationship he had, or the non-relationship he had with Louis Freeh, was so bad that Janet Reno had to literally translate messages. They wouldn't even talk to each other. And Louis Freeh was out publicly trashing Clinton, who he was working for. So that was an odd situation. The opposite is, of course, the idea that what we're talking about now is the extent to which the White House circumscribed, or appeared to have circumscribed, this investigation so that all of these 30 witnesses that you've laid out in your article were not talked to. So does that mean that there should be some kind of way to insulate the FBI from the executive branch?
Well, again, I think people are getting confused between criminal investigations and background checks, which are administrative. The FBI is doing this at the behest of the White House, just like they might do it for, you know, another agency, the IRS, for example. They're hiring people and they want the employees to get background checks. The FBI might do that if that's what is part of their mandate. So this isn't a question. I mean, it's impossible to have that kind of insulation when you've created, you know, the entity as essentially being a subcontractor for the customer here, as is the White House. It's really the White House's call, what they believe to be problematic in the file of a person that they might be hiring, and they can choose to let the FBI could have just said, we don't want to have any supplemental investigation at all, and that would have been within their purview. So, you know, just like if they had hired an outside agency, I mean, I think I would, that's a good way to think about it. Like, imagine they, you know, hired the Acme Detective Agency to do this background check. It would really, you know, the Acme Detective Agency would do whatever the White House told them. That is their client in that case. So I don't think this is a situation like with Clinton or even with Trump and the Russia investigation, where there is an ongoing criminal investigation where the White House could interfere with the administration of justice. This is not about the administration of justice. This is about finding information regarding the candidate's suitability. I think that there was much more information that they needed to find out, but that is really up to the White House. And I mean, just to give you a background, remember that Rob Porter, one of the White House staff, was working there even though his background check had turned up, allegations of domestic violence. The White House didn't feel that that was a problem. So, you know, I think just the FBI's role here is just limited in this context.
So do you think, though, the FBI, let's face it, the FBI is under relentless attack by the president himself, and he's called it corrupt and broken and all of these very charged descriptions. But on top of that, it would seem now that a lot of people are going to be very disappointed in this investigation, particularly on the Democratic side, and they may well harbor ill will towards the FBI. So it seems that the FBI has been in a situation where they're damned if they don't and damned if they do.
I think that's right. I mean, the FBI has kind of been thrust into what is essentially a political decision. And all of these decisions, whether to reopen the supplemental check, the scope of it, what to do with the information they find, all of these are political decisions that are not for the FBI to make. You know, it's not like a criminal investigation where the FBI decides or the Department of Justice decides we're going to prosecute this person. That's not what's going on here. So they've been thrust into this political process. And, you know, once again, we just have a situation where the White House is, I think, operating, you know, they don't care about norms and they're willing to just do whatever they want. And I think the unfortunate thing here, Ian, is that it's really the credibility of the Supreme Court that's going to suffer in all of this. I mean, at the end of the day, the President Trump is the president, and even if he had pulled Judge Kavanaugh's name, he could have nominated another conservative. So, you know, they wouldn't have really lost anything in terms of their ultimate goal of having another conservative on the court. But there's kind of an ego thing happening with the, you know, not letting the Democrats win, or I don't know what it is. And unfortunately, I think it's the reputation of the Supreme Court that's going to suffer in the process.
So just in the last couple of minutes, then, Usher Rangappa, does that mean, because I remember speaking a few days ago with Congressman Ted Lieu, who's on the House Judiciary Committee, and he was talking about the possibility that they may look into impeachment, particularly if they win the House, of Judge Kavanaugh. This is before he was seated, going back to what they considered to be some less than truthful statements he made in his earlier confirmations. Now, of course, since he had that outburst that the whole world saw on television, there are more questions, certainly about his objectivity, but also about his honesty. Do you think this could linger, that it's possible that he could get seated on the Supreme Court and then be impeached?
I think it's possible, and I think that there are, you know, if it is substantiated or proven that he lied during his confirmation hearings under oath, those would be impeachable offenses. Again, this is just not something you want to happen to the Supreme Court. You know, I mean, it's even thrown around for the president, and you know, it's incredibly traumatic for the country when an official in that high of a position is impeached. It makes people lose faith in the integrity, you know, and unfortunately, by even placing those people in those positions in the first place, people already have lost faith in the integrity. So it's just a downward spiral. I think it could happen. I don't think it would be unjustified. I think it would be really sad, too.
So, just in closing, no silver linings. I mean, this is a pretty, I think a lot of people are feeling quite bitter. And I'm not sure that in their celebration, even Mitch McConnell and the Republicans unnecessarily have a great victory on their hands. How do you see it? It seems to me...
Oh, it's a Pyrrhic victory, Ian. I mean, as I mentioned, they're going to get what they want at, you know, they're going to burn down the Supreme Court in the meantime. People lose faith in its legitimacy when every other institution is under attack, and this is the one that is probably the most revered institution in our country. You know, those nine people in robes where they hand down decisions and we might disagree with them vehemently, but we respect it. And for it to potentially lose that respect would be a tragedy, I think, for the United States. And I think what's really sad is just what I just mentioned, is that there is another way out. I mean, you know, they could pull, if they wanted to, they could pull this. They could have someone even more conservative. They could nominate a conservative woman and diffuse a lot of this in terms of, you know, accusations that they are not taking issues of sexual assault and women's, you know, just kind of women as women seriously. But I'm sorry to say I don't think there is a silver lining for this, and I think it's just another instance where, you know, you're going to see a sad day in America.
Well, Asha Rangappa, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Asha Rangappa, who's Associate Dean at Yale Law School, who teaches national security law and related courses at Wesleyan University and the Jackson Institute for Global Affairs at Yale University. Previously, she served as a special agent at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, specializing in counterintelligence investigation, and now is a political analyst at CNN, and she co-authored the article at Just Security, "Here Are the 30 People the FBI Needs to Interview in Its Kavanaugh Investigation." We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the moral bankruptcy of the so-called Christians, reflected in a recent study that found that over 40% of the evangelicals would still support Kavanaugh for the Supreme Court, even if he was found guilty of the sexual assault of a 15-year-old girl.
So excuse me, mister, but I'm a mister too, and you're giving mister a bad name, mister like you. So I'm taking the mister from out in front of your name, 'cause it's mister like you that puts the rest of us to shame. It's a mister like you.
God is a concept by which we measure our pain. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't believe.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Frank Schaefer, who is the best-selling author of fiction and nonfiction. His parents, Francis and Edith Schaefer, were world-famous evangelical speakers and authors, and he previously worked with such figures as Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and focused on the family's James Dobson. Frank Schaefer, however, felt increasingly alienated and experienced a crisis of faith that would ultimately lead to his departure from the evangelical movement, and his novels include Portofino, and Saving Grandma, and his non-fiction books include Crazy for God, Patience with God, Faith for People Who Don't Like Religion or Atheism, Sex, Mum and God, and his latest, Letters to Lucy, a manifesto of creative redemption in the age of Trump, fascism and lies. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frank Schaefer.
Hey, Ian, it is always wonderful to talk to you. How have you been?
Very well. I'm just getting over a cold, but I'm still in the age of Trump, being whipsawed every day by what happens on a daily basis, government by stunt, a reality TV star. But you have to admit, at this moment, it looks like the Republicans have totally smoked the Democrats, and they're going to seat Kavanaugh on the court.
I think they will, and I think it's going to energize their far-right Republican voters who all lined up behind Trump and laughed their heads off when he mocked a woman who was assaulted as a 15-year-old child. That's the State of the Union.
Well, it's going from bad to worse. I agree. Although Senator Ben Sasse was so upset with what Trump said at the rally in Mississippi the other night, where he trashed Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, that he feels that Trump is unable to lead this country. Is there going to be a moral backlash here, do you think? I mean, where are the traditional Republicans and the traditional Christian values in this country? What happened to them?
Well, as you know, in your introduction of me, you said that my parents, Francis and Nita Schaefer, were well-known evangelicals. They were more than that. They were the founders of the religious right, along with people like Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson. And back in the 70s and 80s, I was out on the road with them, basically stirring up the hornet's nest of what became the evangelical wing of the anti-abortion movement. And I ran away from this and left my nepotistic sidekick role and became a filmmaker and novelist and writer back in the late 80s and early 90s. But I do know the people involved. I know people like Ralph Reed. I know the people who started the Values Voters Summit in Washington and all these guys. And all I can say is that if back in the day you had told them that they would be backing a man who mocked someone who was assaulted as a child, if you told them he mocked the handicapped, if you told them that he was not just a philanderer but proud of assaulting women and bragged about it on tape, that he paid off porn stars, and that they, 35 years hence, would be not only voting for him but making excuses for him up into including calling someone of Dr. Ford's caliber a liar or a very credible witness against him, no one would have believed you. So I think what we have illustrated here is that the quest for political power by the evangelical right has turned them at this stage of their evolution into what has to be called a group of followers of a personality cult that has authoritarian, even Orwellian totalitarian overtones. They've not only sold out the kind of evangelical faith I was raised to embrace, that I've left, but nevertheless, that was about loving your neighbor and caring for people, the kind of evangelical faith that rose up and produced people like Dr. Martin Luther King, who would quote the Bible in reference to liberation and dignity and human rights and many, many others. And it has now become what you saw in Mississippi the other night, and that is just another version of a white lynch mob, literally, lynching the memories, lynching the women who have been assaulted by this crude, horrible manifestation of men and women together waving Trump signs, laughing at someone being assaulted and joining with Trump in his mockery of her, very much like when he mocked a handicapped person, very much like when he mocked the family of a soldier killed in combat. And so this isn't a rare one-off episode. This is just the next event in watching several stories unfold. And one is, of course, the Trump story, the takeover of our country by a con artist. Has this long New York Times expose of his dad and him and his tax machinations to avoid taxes, to duck taxes, to cheat. They use the word fraud in the article, all of these things. And then on the next side, the whole Russian involvement and all the rest of that. But another story that gets buried sometimes that I know you pay close attention to, which is why you call me, and I'm grateful to be able to get my say here, is the complete rot that has taken place in what used to be called the so-called silent majority or the moral majority in this country that styled itself all about family values. So what we see now is that this has become an abortion-obsessed personality cult that cares nothing for any of the moral principles that they once said they held dear. Everything from telling the truth to integrity in government, lack of corruption, all of these things have been swept away in their adulation of this figure who has given them inside access to the White House. And I'll just add this one note. Everybody who looks around and says, you know, Trump has basically let everyone down except for billionaires, that's not true. He has punched every single box, ticked every box on the card that evangelicals like Ralph Reed and Franklin Graham gave him in terms of the kind of judges he's appointed, in terms of his anti-gay initiatives and rhetoric, in terms of his so-called religious liberty rhetoric, which is all about actually religious liberty for white evangelical Christians and no one else, in rolling back not only bits and pieces of Obamacare, attacking pre-existing conditions coverage and so forth. All these things, when you put it together, signal the utter corruption not only of the Republican Party, which is now just this kind of lickspittle enabling group to this disgusting man, but they have, but what we've watched is Trump literally sort of push the creaky old wheelchair of the evangelical movement up to a precipice and push it over. So the evangelical movement, Ian, as of today, is no more, as those words meant something, say, back in the day in the 70s and 80s was that when I was out with my dad. We had a lot of things wrong, but we were not fascists. We were not trying to undo the American political system and replace it with this authoritarian claptrap. We were not into mocking handicapped people and mocking women who had been assaulted. This is new. It's not new on the face of the earth. There have always been people like this. But it's new that an entire movement that branded itself once as about family values and dignity and human worth and created what they called the pro-life movement, pro-life, taking care of people. This was their whole shtick. Mm-hmm. Well, now this kind of these anti-abortion fanatics have lost sight of even their pro-life commitment. They're no longer even pro-life. What they are is they are pro-Trump. And Trump is an angel of death, literally. He is a disgusting person, but he's also, with his lies and all the rest of it and his meanness and his nastiness, he has brought a tone into American politics that in my 66 years I've never seen. I've had a lot of Republicans I've disagreed with, but I can assure you if somehow a character like him had become president as a liberal Democrat, I would be working my ass off to get him out of office based on character. This is a horrible person, irrespective of his politics, and that's really where we're at. And the evangelicals have completely fallen for it, and they've gone for it. They're an utterly discredited group of people. Every time you go by a big white evangelical church, you are basically looking at the equivalent of Hitler Youth. That's the deal. These people are totally in bed with this guy. They will stand behind him rank upon rank and laugh at a woman who was assaulted at age 15. This is the bottom. This is the pit. So from here on out, Ian, there's no more unthinkables in this country. And I have to tell you honestly, if people who stand up against Trump were, you know, in Russia with his friend Vladimir Putin, they would be being killed, of course. But here, what he does is just try to mock them into the ground and energize his base to ratchet up the level of hate against the media and the free press and free speech and all the rest of it every opportunity he gets. And now he's just attacked the person. A credible, dignified, wonderful woman who has lived an exemplary life, who's a professor, who is if she's not believable, then nobody is. And he's not just calling her a liar, he's mocking her. So we've reached the bottom now. He has done what he said he could do, and that is shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and get away with it. I mean, literally, if you came up with an example of something extreme and you said, I could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and get away with it, what else would be more extreme than that? I don't know. Cannibalism? No. But if you said, I could make fun of a rape victim, a child rape victim, and get away with it, that would be right up there with that. And he's done it. So we've reached the bottom now. There's no place to go from here but down.
And again, I'm speaking with Frank Schaefer, who's the best-selling author of fiction and nonfiction. His parents, Francis and Edith Schaefer, were world-famous evangelical speakers and authors, and he previously worked with such figures as Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and focused on the family's James Dobson. However, he felt increasingly alienated and experienced a crisis of faith that would ultimately lead to his departure from the evangelical movement. And his novels include Portofino and Saving Grandma, and his nonfiction books include Crazy for God, Patience with God, Faith for People Who Don't Like Religion or Atheism, Sex, Mum, and God. And his latest book is Letters to Lucy, A Manifesto of Creative Redemption in the Age of Trump, Fascism, and Lies. And just to buttress what you just told us, Frank, a recent poll found that over 40% of evangelicals in this country would back Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court, even if the sex assault allegations were proven. What I find extraordinary is that we have already this theater that went on, in effect, with the White House circumscribing. To this day, we don't know what the parameters of the FBI investigation were, and the White House won't say so. So this was obviously railroaded through, and, you know, let's face it, Kavanaugh worked closely with both Chris Wray and the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, when he was in the George W. Bush White House. And, of course, Chris Wray, the head of the FBI, was 2 years behind Kavanaugh at Yale. There is a sort of – and they're all members of the Federalist Society along with Don McGahn. So – and we know how extraordinarily successful the Federalists have been in putting five, if this guy is the fifth, on the court. And the leader of the Federalist Society, Leonard Leo, is a member of the ultra-right-wing Knights of Malta. That's the different side of – religious fundamentalism in this country. You've got the Protestant evangelicals that your parents were the leaders in organizing the religious right. But then you've got this compact with the far right-wing Catholics. And Kavanaugh will be the fifth of when you think of Roberts, Alito, Thomas, Gorsuch, and now Kavanaugh, those are very five extremely conservative right-wing Catholics. They hardly represent the broad diversity of the United States, let alone the diversity within the Catholic Church.
Well, more than that, just think, the seat that these Republicans held open by refusing to even have hearings for President Obama was to fill another far right-wing Roman Catholic seat, Scalia, who had passed away, and they held that seat open so they could get not just a clone in terms of the legal philosophy, but someone that makes Scalia look like a moderate when it comes to his Kavanaugh's public viper-like strikes and hatred, venom-soaked hatred against not just women and his mockery of Dr. Ford in implying that she's just a liar or deluded or whatever it might be, but in terms of his obvious desire to take revenge on what he regards as the Clinton Party, the liberals, these other folks, in the same way that his own conduct is unimaginable to see seated on the court, just the side of his open, public sneering at liberals and Democrats and his reaching down even into the kind of insane conspiracy theory territory so many Republicans on the right online have gone, this isn't even a mainstream conservative Republican. Mainstream Republicans like George W. Bush, who, by the way, I knew personally, I have handwritten notes from his late mother thanking me for, you know, my family's work and so forth back when we were connected with the religious right. I mean, you can't imagine George W. Bush on his worst day thinking that it would be okay to put somebody on the court who would act this way. Now, in private, over a drink, whatever it might be, they might talk that way. But even they once had the good sense to not act this way. So what another thing that Trump has let out of the box in this sort of Pandora's box that's opened on us is a new group of Republicans like Kavanaugh who don't even pretend to be part of the American system as we understand it. The judiciary used to at least present itself as neutral and open and interested in the national good and the Constitution. And we've now gotten to a place where in a hearing, we have someone clearly not only act like, but clearly lay out what in fact is a manifesto of bad manners on behalf of far-right conspiracy theory-type Republican white trash. There's no other way to put this. Just the gutter bottom of the Republican Party, the kind of people like Alex Jones and these others. That's who's now heading into the Supreme Court on the back of having tried to discredit, a woman who was assaulted at age 15. So when you know, and then of course there's this horrible asymmetry with the fact that this is the man who's going to be the deciding vote on rolling back Roe v. Wade, but that's only going to be the tip of the iceberg. It's everything to do with women's rights.
Well, just in the last minute, Frank, just to sort of round off this idea of how far the religious right has fallen from grace, a new movie is called The Chosen One. It's a film that claims that Donald Trump's election was an act of God, and it's opening in more than 1,000 cinemas across the country on Friday, The Trump Prophecy, which posits that God chose the philandering billionaire to restore America's moral values. I'm not making this
well,
up.
You know, all I can say is where have we come to? But I will go further than that and say, listen, you know, I wrote a book called Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God. So that's where my head is at. That said, if I was still in my old fundamentalist Christian ways and still believed what I believed as a fundamentalist evangelical in the 60s and 70s as the son of an evangelist, I would be saying, you're right. Trump has been brought to this country by God because America has fallen so far from God's grace that this is the ultimate judgment and damnation against this nation. So the funny thing is, by the standards of the evangelical movement that I was part of in the 60s and 70s, you could spin this another way, and that is you could have made a movie based on the morality they said they adhered to, family values, fidelity, truth, compassion, love, becoming Christ-like, wanting people to imitate Jesus. What would Jesus do? All the rest of this. For those who haven't been along for the ride, if you put them in a time machine and brought them to this moment and watched Donald Trump mocking a woman who had been assaulted at 15 and said, that's your Christian witness now if you go with this guy. Look, there are your fellow evangelicals laughing. They would have said, these people are bringing damnation on the United States. And if there's a movie about how Donald Trump is an instrument of God, it is as an instrument of judgment that, like some Old Testament prophecy or even in the book of Revelation or even one of the Proverbs, in the book of Proverbs, Solomon's Proverbs, it's like that. I've given you a fool and a clown and an oppressor.
Right, and even
for your king.
And you mentioned the book of Revelation. Maybe he's even the Antichrist. I'm afraid we've run out of time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Frank. but I thank you.
All joking aside, that's the deal.
Right. Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you very much. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Frank Schaefer, who's the best-selling author of fiction and nonfiction. His parents, Francis and Edith Schaefer, were world-famous evangelical speakers and authors, and he previously worked with such figures as Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and focused on the family's James Dobson. However, he felt increasingly alienated and experienced a crisis of faith that would ultimately lead to his departure from the evangelical movement. And his novels include Portofino and Saving Grandma, and his nonfiction books include Crazy for God, Patience with God, Faith for People Who Don't Like Religion or Atheism, Sex, Mum, and God. And his latest book is Letters to Lucy, A Manifesto of Creative Redemption in the Age of Trump, Fascism, and Lies. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with world-renowned presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodman about her latest book, Leadership in Turbulent Times. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Doris Kearns Goodwin, a world-renowned presidential historian and Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times number one best-selling author who worked for Lyndon Johnson in the White House and later assisted him on his memoirs, which led to her best-selling Lyndon Johnson and the American Dream. Her other books include the Pulitzer Prize-winning No Ordinary Time, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, The Home Front in World War II, and the runaway bestseller Team of Rivals, the basis for Steven Spielberg's Academy Award-winning film Lincoln, for which she earned the Lincoln Prize. And her latest book just out is Leadership in Turbulent Times. Doris will be speaking and signing books tonight at 8 p.m. at the Aretani Theater at the Japanese American Cultural Center, 244 St. Pedro Street in downtown Los Angeles at 8 p.m. Welcome to Background Briefing, Doris Kearns Goodwin.
Hello, I'm glad to be with you.
Well, thank you. And just yesterday, Senator Ben Sasse, a Republican senator, in condemning President Trump's mockery of Dr. Ford at a rally in Mississippi, said that President Trump is unable to lead the country. When you compare to your book, your new book, Leadership in Turbulent Times, where you profile Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin D. Roosevelt, and Lyndon Johnson, that is a pretty stark contrast, is it not, particularly coming from a Republican senator?
I do think so. I mean, in fact, each of the four leaders that I've looked at in terms of leadership were in a situation that really called for a leader to heal divisions, to bring various parts of the country together, you know, to summon the citizenry to a sense of common purpose. And I think what we're seeing today is, rather than bringing people together, the leadership is fomenting and exacerbating divisions, which is, I think, what he was talking about. Stoking one's base is not leadership. It's governance by faction. So I think if you compare them, in fact, one of the hopes I have for people looking back at these crisis situations, which were much worse than ours, even though we feel like we're in the worst of times, is that when you have a leader in place, it can shine light on what the absence of leadership seems to be today.
Well, there is an explanation for what happened down in Mississippi, and it seems the more logical one, is that President Trump was constrained by his handlers. They even described the situation as treating him like a Fabergé egg, basically saying, just don't trash Dr. Ford. And for a while, the president was very restrained and respectful of her and said nice things about it. But it appears that he simply couldn't constrain himself, that he just doesn't have the discipline. And this leads you to question his ability or the fact that he's the steward of the nuclear button. I mean, that is what the way I interpret it. How do you interpret it?
No, I think you're right. I think there seemed to be, during the early days after the Kavanaugh hearings, it was almost as if he had put a girdle on himself or the handlers had put one on him, and for the good of the country. I mean, controlling negative emotions is such an important thing to do. Lincoln was able to do it by writing hot letters to people and then just putting them aside, never sending them, knowing he could cool down psychologically. And when you're the steward of the people, not just of the nuclear button, your responsibility is to act in a manner that your words are going to carry weight to the country. And somehow, when he got before that crowd, and the anger that was within him bubbled up from inside, and that certainly didn't help the situation, even help the acceptance now, if they do put this Mr. Kavanaugh into the Supreme Court. What you needed the president to do was to be a healing force and say that her testimony was credible, but perhaps they're going to claim the FBI report didn't corroborate it. But he already made it into a partisan situation, which is going to make healing from this decision harder, make the Supreme Court's legitimacy harder, make the FBI harder now, which is the opposite of what you hope a leader would do.
And the presidents you profile in your new book, Doris Kearns Goodwin, Leadership in Turbulent Times, Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin D. Roosevelt, and Lyndon Johnson, all of them were faced with one crisis or another. Nothing was more intense, obviously, than the Civil War itself. We haven't had a crisis with this president. And if you think about JFK at the time of the Cuba crisis in 1962, what I take away from it is that Kennedy was being badgered by his Joint Chiefs of Staff and particularly by Curtis LeMay to, you know, nuke Cuba and preemptively take out the Russian missiles. Well, we learned in retrospect that the Russian officers in charge of the nuclear weapons they had in Cuba had orders to fire these weapons in a counterforce strike without having to get approval from the Kremlin. So had JFK listened to Curtis LeMay and his Joint Chiefs of Staff, we would have had a nuclear war back in 1962. My fear is that with this particularly unstable president we have, he doesn't have, except for James Mattis, who's apparently on his way out, he doesn't have sober people around him. He has sycophants and hawks like John Bolton and Mike Pompeo. They're likely to goad him in a crisis situation as opposed to restrain him.
You know, and I think the worrisome thing about the experience with JFK and this experience now, too, is that JFK had learned from the mistakes of the Bay of Pigs that he couldn't rely on intelligence from above, that he couldn't rely on his generals. He acknowledged the mistakes he had made and restructured his White House to bring Bobby Kennedy closer into the decision-making structure, all of which meant when he came to that decision in the Cuban Missile Crisis, he was much better prepared because he had learned through his growth. And that's one of the things that we keep looking for. Indeed, I do, and all my leaders, they somehow were able to acknowledge their errors, learn from their mistakes. As Lincoln said, I'd like to believe I'm smarter today than I was yesterday because I've learned what I did wrong. And it's that learning process that we have not yet seen. We keep waiting for, and it hasn't happened. And then you are more liable to listen to advice from somebody else without bringing in the people that can really question your assumptions. That's one of the things that Lincoln did by having those rivals in his cabinet. They could all argue with him. So when he had to make a decision, he could take their alternative points of view into consideration.
And again, I'm speaking with Doris Kearns Goodwin, a world-renowned presidential historian and Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times number one best-selling author who worked for Lyndon Johnson in the White House and later assisted him on his memoirs, which led to her best-selling Lyndon Johnson and the American Dream. Her other books include the Pulitzer Prize-winning No Ordinary Time, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, The Home Front in World War II, and the runaway bestseller Team of Rivals, the basis for Steven Spielberg's Academy Award-winning film Lincoln, for which she earned the Lincoln Prize. And her latest book just out is Leadership in Turbulent Times. Well, in the example of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who took office in 1933, where people were starving in the streets and there were food riots, etc., what I found interesting about that in terms of contrasting it to the 2008 crash, which I think is the closest contrast you can make, President Obama is being criticized now by people like George Soros and others who are basically saying he shouldn't have followed the advice of George W. Bush's Secretary of Treasury and other Wall Street types. He should have done what FDR did, because between the election of FDR and taking office in January of 1933, the incumbent Hoover was begging FDR to help him out, and FDR didn't. So do you think there's a lesson there?
Interesting. I mean, FDR understood that he needed a clear line of demarcation when he took office that would show that something new was beginning. Even though he used the Hoover advisors when he decided he wanted to have an emergency banking bill to close the banks and come up with some system that could shore up the weaker banks and then let the stronger ones stay open again once they reopened the doors. But in public, he thought it was important that he show that this is a new situation that's developing, because the country was going on a downward slide and you had to feel that something new was happening. But I think also the difference is when FDR presented his emergency banking bill to the Congress, Republicans and Democrats immediately came together to support it. You know, and one of the criticisms that's sometimes made of President Obama is, why wasn't the stimulus bill larger? Well, he could barely get this one through on the Republican side. So there was never able to be that bipartisanship that was in the Depression, because perhaps the crisis was greater. So people were willing to put partisanship aside, and they weren't still in that period of time during the recession of 08.
And of course, two of your presidents, Theodore Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson, were accidental presidents, I guess, if that's the way to put
Correct.
It, having their presidents assassinated. So let's just touch on Theodore Roosevelt. Of course, you write about the coal strike. He, of course, his great legacy is antitrust. And there's a growing call in this country for some movement on antitrust. It's all but moribund. And there are these huge tech companies now. It used to be only, 10 years ago that ExxonMobil was the most powerful company in the world. But now you've got Amazon, Microsoft, Apple, and Facebook. These are the most powerful companies, Amazon, and they're going to be more powerful. So do you think that that is the legacy that has to be revived? I mean, not only revive antitrust, but my God, think about the people that back then, in terms of the muckrakers, Ida Tarbell, who leaked all the important information about the Standard Oil Trust, and of course, Mark Twain. So, two questions, right. I guess. What happened to the muckrakers? And two, when are we going to see some antitrust action?
Well, I think you raise a really interesting parallel between the situation at the turn of the 20th century and where we are right now, because that Gilded Age was an age when you had the first time a real gap between the rich and the poor, when the Industrial Revolution had shaken up the economy, much as the tech revolution and globalization have done today, when you had immigrants coming into the country, when there were big companies swallowing up small companies, and the inequities of the age were so glaring. And luckily, Teddy Roosevelt came along and not only broke up the big companies to some extent, but he also understood that you had to have a square deal for the rich and the poor, the capitalist and the wage worker, and instituted a series of regulations of big business, of the railroads, you know, of the various companies that were important to get government into this mix of private enterprise. And we're facing a similar situation today. Again, the rural areas feel cut off from the cities, just as they did at the turn of the 20th century. You had all these inventions at the turn of the 20th century, the automobile and the telephone and the telegraph, which made people anxious and wanting to go back to an earlier time. And, of course, we have the same pace of life today. So, but this, the answer calls for looking at the situation and trying to make the situation better, and whether some of those steps are antitrust, whether they're regulation, or whether they're, as Teddy was saying, a square deal on both sides, I think is what is in calls for today. But we have to think about how to deal with this economy and the social and cultural divisions that are facing us today and how to make it more equitable so that people feel a sense of being common. Teddy Roosevelt said the rock of democracy would founder at the time when people no longer regarded each other as Americans, but rather as the other from different classes, sections, or regions. And you're right about Ida Tarbell. I mean, she's my hero in a lot of ways, a woman who was able to investigate the unfair means by which Standard Oil had reached its eminence, and eventually her research helped to break up Standard Oil. But then, of course, all the little Standard Oils became huge companies, including Exxon, as you point out.
But in terms of journalism, obviously, the New York Times and Washington Post are doing an extraordinary job, but we do have what is referred to as reality shopping, where liberals get their information from MSNBC and conservatives from Fox. So there's no consensus anymore in this country about what is real and what is true. Is that something that, you know, I'm thinking about the days of Uncle Walter Cronkite reading the news where everybody, that was sort of the gospel. Is that gone forever, or were there other periods in our history when we had, as Kellyanne Conway referred to, alternative facts?
Well, it is true that in the 1850s, when the main way you got your news was from your partisan subscription to your own Whig paper or Democratic paper or Republican paper, you would definitely hear alternative facts in their descriptions of events. I mean, that's because they were projecting just to the partisans. But then national newspapers began to develop, partly because of reporters covering the Civil War. And then by the turn of the century, you had all sorts of national newspapers. When the radio came in and FDR was able to speak to the country with one voice over a radio that 8 out of 10 people would be listening to, sure, there'd be other radio stations and editorials on them, but his voice was able to give a consistent message that everybody listened to, more than entertainment, more than sporting events. They're sitting in their kitchens or living rooms listening to him. And then, as you point out, when the three television networks were there, JFK and Ronald Reagan were able to speak with one voice, at least on the facts could be agreed on, even though the opinions might be different about them. Then once we got the split up of the cable news, once we got social media, once we got people just looking in their own silos, it's made it much, much harder. There's got to be an answer to it. I'm not sure I can think of what it is right now, but, you know, we've had problems before, as FDR said, problems created by man can be solved by man. So somewhere out there, there's ways we can think about how to draw a common press together that people respect and look at in the same way. But first, we have to heal some of these cultural divisions that underlay the reason why they listen to their own preferred press.
So let's turn to President Lyndon Johnson, who you work for, and your husband Richard Goodwin also worked for him, and I used to interview Richard many years ago.
No kidding.
Yeah,
oh, boy.
Yeah. It feels like such a bygone era when you think about how much LBJ accomplished: the Civil Rights Act, 64, the Voting Rights Act, Medicare, and so much more. So I guess the question that comes to mind is, what happened to the liberals in this country? When you think back at LBJ's time and how much he got done, and for quite some time after, all the way through the 70s, the liberals dominated the Senate, the House, and the Supreme Court. I mean, arguably, when we talk about liberals on the Supreme Court, many of them could be really categorized as centrist, not like the real liberals that we had back in those days with William O. Douglas and Thurgood Marshall, etc. So it feels to me, and I don't know what the answer is, but somehow when you look at what happened today, where the Republicans just roll the Democrats and they're going to buffalo this guy onto the Supreme Court, and he's so troubling because he's so nakedly partisan, that if you're a Democrat or a Democratic governor going before the Supreme Court with Brett Kavanaugh on the bench, you are not going to be treated fairly. That's just obvious. So am I correct in suggesting something happened where we had a liberal majority in this country and in all branches of the government, and now we seem to have a conservative majority in all branches of the government?
Well, I think there was a shared story that the liberals shared and that, you know, liberal Republicans would share with them, which was especially on civil rights, that in order for the country to move forward, you know, segregation had to end in the South. Then when Johnson gave the famous "We Shall Overcome" speech that my husband, I'm so proud of saying, worked on with him, he's saying this is not a Negro problem, not a white problem. It's not a Democratic problem. It's not a Republican problem, not a Northern problem, not a Southern problem. It's an American problem, and we are met here to solve that problem. There was a sense, I think, of common citizenry that allowed LBJ, for example, during that time, to get Everett Dirksen, the Republican minority leader, to come with him on that civil rights bill to break the filibuster. That's an impossible situation to imagine today, that you could mobilize 22 people from the opposite side to go with the 44 Northern Democrats and break that filibuster and change the face of the country. And somewhere along the line, we still need a story now from the liberals and from the Democrats that binds us together as a nation, that understands why these people who felt left out of the system, felt that elites were running the system, whether Trump answered any of their concerns or not, they have to feel part of the solution that's going forward. And to some extent, I think there's so many silos, so many identity politics that have been going on, and there's a narrative that needs to be run before this next election, if in fact the liberals are going to gain, or even the Democrats are going to gain the narrative story that the country wants to hear.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Doris Kearns Goodwin, I just wanted you to, if you would, get an invocation from you as to why our listeners should get your book. I know why they should, but I'd like to hear it from you.
Well, I'd like to think that, you know, we feel we are in the worst of times, and by seeing that we had other times more difficult than these, but somehow with leaders, and more importantly, with leaders that were joined with citizens who were aroused. I mean, the anti-slavery movement, as Lincoln said, was irresponsible, not he as a liberator alone. Without the progressive movement, what FDR and Teddy Roosevelt did would have been impossible. Without the civil rights movement, LBJ could not have gotten the civil rights bill through, or the voting rights bill. So right now, the answer is an awakened citizenry for us. It's the way we come together that's going to make the difference right now. And I do think there are signs of awakening. We're seeing it in the renewed interest in politics among the young. We're seeing it in record-breaking numbers of women that are running for office for the first time. So it's really on us right now to see what we can do and not just wait for leaders to lead us, but to lead the leaders from the bottom up, which is why change and social justice has always happened in the past. And this book shows that that combination of the leader fitted for the time and an aroused citizenry working in tandem with those leaders really were able to bring about positive social justice, economic opportunity, change that made our nation stronger.
Well, just
I think it gives us hope. I hope it gives us hope and it stimulates us to act.
Right. Well, just in closing, though, I think you could make the case, surely, that throughout history, going back through slavery and all of the great challenges, World War II, fascism, civil rights, human rights, women's rights, it's always been the liberals that did the heavy lifting. The conservatives just said no, all the way through history. So why are liberals defensive? They should be proud of what they've achieved.
I agree with you totally. I mean, you look back, and I think even now, 50 years from LBJ's leaving office, and of course the war in Vietnam cut that legacy in two, but think of what was achieved during that period of time that's part of the foundation of our everyday life today. Civil rights, voting rights, fair housing, Medicare, aid to education, NPR, PBS, Head Start, immigration reform. It's an extraordinary record to be proud of. And the alliances that came out of World War II during Truman's administration, it's an extraordinary thing to be proud of. And you have to run on pride of what you've accomplished and moving forward into a future that's built on similar kinds of situations that you brought to bear that leadership in the past.
Well, Doris Kearns Goodwin, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Oh, you're so very welcome. Thank you.
And we've been speaking with Doris Kearns Goodwin, who's a world-renowned presidential historian and Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times number one best-selling author, who worked for Lyndon Johnson in the White House and later assisted him on his memoirs, which led to her best-selling Lyndon Johnson and the American Dream. Her other books include the Pulitzer Prize-winning No Ordinary Time, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, The Home Front in World War II, and the runaway bestseller Team of Rivals, the basis for Steven Spielberg's Academy Award-winning film Lincoln, for which she earned the Lincoln Prize. And her latest book just out is Leadership in Turbulent Times. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Love.